Welcome to the Muckreads Podcast. I'm Marshall Allen, and I report on healthcare for ProPublica. The Muckreads Podcast is a discussion between two journalists who talk about the story behind the story. Today, I'm joined by John Branch, a sports reporter for the New York Times. We're discussing his series Punched Out, which depicts the tragic descent of professional hockey enforcer Derek Bogard, whose on-ice brawls led to concussions, drug addiction, brain injury, and eventually, his death. The series exposes the culture of violence in hockey, as well as the problems caused by head injuries, drug addiction, and the careless prescribing of doctors. John's work was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. He joined us in the ProPublica studio on Wednesday, June 6th.
The series was about the life and death of Derek Bogard. And Derek Bogard was an NHL hockey player. An enforcer was his role. And for people that aren't real familiar with hockey, that's somebody whose role is not to score goals necessarily, but it's basically to come onto the ice and be an intimidator, somebody who is a bodyguard for the more skilled players. And so by doing so, you fight a lot. Hockey has kind of a strange little sideshow, I guess you might call it, where players will come out and fight to sort of take care of one another's grievances. And so Derek Bogard became one of the best fighters in the National Hockey League. And he died in May of 2011 of a drug overdose of pain pills and alcohol. And so the story was really about Derek's rise from a small town in Saskatchewan, the realization that he was not going to become a hockey player any other way than by basically using his fists, and then going from sort of unskilled hockey player to one of the kings of the NHL in terms of his reputation as a fighter and most feared guys in the league. And it was a kind of a behind-the-scenes look at the life that he led and then his downfall, including the fact that his family then donated his brain upon his death. And examiners or researchers at Boston University then found that he had CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, and a pretty advanced case of it from trauma to the head.
Now, I liked one thing that was so interesting is the way you used Derek's story to really draw on broader themes and broader issues that are affecting not just sports, but also the rest of our culture. So what are some of those broader themes that you used to use this story as a device to get into these issues?
Yeah, I mean, some of those broader themes, and that's the reason why I like the story, too. You know, as much as it's a story about one boy or one man, I think there's some universal themes involved. You know, that includes things like concussions, which is obviously our hot topic in the sports world and elsewhere. So the fact that he had so many concussions and nobody really ever paid attention to the trauma that was going on in his head, they were more worried, and the family even says sort of regrettably now that they were always more worried about his hands and the arthritis that the fighting might cause more than they were ever worried about his head. So it wasn't really until the recent couple of years that people started paying attention to that. Drug use is another one. You know, he was abusing drugs and became an addict in the last couple of years of his career, getting a lot of drugs from team doctors, and written a little bit about that system and what seems to be a flawed system there. And also the fact that he was buying a lot off the street from people who were more than willing to sell them to him in Minneapolis and in New York and other places. So those are probably the two main ones, I think, the concussion science and the drug use. Both very prominent issues in sports, I think, right now.
One of the, I think, most interesting sort of elements of the story is that you have this fearsome enforcer and this notorious tough guy and just this absolute bruiser. But when you told the story, you turned this, I mean, they are self-described goons, right? But you turned this goon into a really sympathetic character, and you showed the vulnerability of the position that he was in. How, I'm assuming this was an intentional way to tell the story. What were the methods you used to really humanize him instead of just focusing on the circus like violence that is typically so celebrated in hockey?
Yeah, the you know, so many athletes, I think it happens in athletics a lot, and especially in a role of an enforcer, we tend to caricaturize these people. You know, we turn them into cartoon characters. They're invincible. We sort of lose sight of the fact that they're real people. They have families. They have their own problems at home. And so I think in any story, you really want to sort of pull back those layers and get to know somebody and what they're really like and sort of avoid the caricature. And with Derek, it was interesting because I was going to be taking a look back at his whole life. That made it much easier because then you can really portray him as a boy. And he was very vulnerable as a boy, not a popular kid. The son of a Canadian Mountie who moved around. His job forced him to move every two or three or four years from one town to another because they don't want their police officers there to get too comfortable in any community. So he'd go from town to town, very small towns, never really fit in. He was always kind of this big kid, wasn't the smartest kid, wasn't the most athletic kid, and struggled a little bit to fit in. And what really, I think, made this much easier for me is the fact that Derek, a couple years before he died, sat down and wrote down a bunch of notes, basically a diary of his early life. And he wrote 16 pages by hand of just all of his memories he can come up with. So everything from car rides with his dad to family dinners to people that came over to his house. And it was mostly steered toward hockey, but a lot of youth hockey. And so going through those notes... And, you know, obviously the hard part about writing about somebody who's just died is that you don't have them to interview. And it was about the closest thing we could get to being able to interview him about his childhood was these, I thought, very nicely written, poignant little anecdotes that he had described about his early life. And that
Do
really
you
helped.
Remember any of them in particular?
Yeah. You know, the car rides with his dad was a big one. He talked a lot about, you know, his dad was a cop. So sometimes the dad would take the cop car, even though he wasn't supposed to. And there'd be boys in the back seat, and they'd have the screen between the seats there. And his dad was kind of a jokester, and would, you know, the kids would all be playing in the back seat. There'd be three or four of them stuck back there on their way to some hockey practice, and his dad would say, "Hey, kids, look, a deer." And they'd all look up and press their face up forward, and then he'd hit the brakes and smash their faces against the glass, and they all thought that was hysterical. You know, people told me stories about, you know, again, with the dad, you know, they'd pull up to a pasture and, they'd take turns mooing at the cows through the PA system.
Oh, that's funny.
Derek wrote about his dad doing donuts in the parking lot of icy parking lots just to try to cheer him up after certain, bat games or whatever. Things like that make you realize there's obviously a lot more to this guy than the fact that he beats people up.
Yeah. And another thing you hit on was, the fear that some of these guys have of fighting. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because it really, you know, I guess I just sort of, when I watch a hockey game and I see a fight, which, by the way, I don't see them in the same way now since reading your stories, I thought that these guys enjoyed it. Like, they're tougher than everyone else, and they just were sort of these fearless, like, superheroes, almost the way you mentioned. And then to hear them talk, not only... Bogard, but other enforcers you talk to talk about the reality of what they feel. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because I think, again, that really went a long way toward humanizing these people.
That was probably the biggest surprise I had during the reporting of this, is that just about everybody I talked to who's an enforcer or a fighter at that level doesn't like what they do. They didn't choose to become an enforcer. It was a fallback position. Just like Derek, they had worked their way up through the juniors and so on. And at some point, the realization came that they weren't going to make it on their skill, but they had something else about them. They were tough guys. They were willing to take punches. They were willing to dish out punishment. And they knew that if they wanted to keep going to the next level, that would be their ticket to it. And so they were kind of drawn into this strange little culture. And you hear them now. I was really surprised. And you hear it especially from guys that are retired because they're willing to admit that they might not be 100% strong and fearless. But even some guys that still play say that, you know, the night before a game, if they know there's a fight the next night, if they know that because the two teams the last time they played, there's some sort of grievance to be settled, and they know that tomorrow I got to fight this guy, they won't sleep the night before. They'll go to a movie the afternoon of the game and walk out of the movie theater and have no idea what they just saw. Their minds are just preoccupied. You know, they go through a lot of pain, and they're not supposed to feel pain. Which I think leads to a lot of anxiety and potentially drugs and alcohol. There aren't a lot of statistics on it, but a lot of people will say anecdotally that of the drug and alcohol problems in hockey, a higher percentage come from guys that do this line of work.
Now, this is another thing that made the series so disturbing. I'm a huge sports fan, and so when I watch sports, it's to disengage from the troubles of life and just enjoy entertainment, right? But when you show the cost and when you humanize these things, and then when I see how systematized the violence is into the game, that's kind of disturbing. It almost creates like a moral obligation and a moral connection for the fan. But can you talk about, because another thing you showed so well was how systematized this was in the sport. This isn't like, I didn't know this, I'm not even a casual hockey fan, but I had no idea how planned out the violence in hockey is. So can you talk about how structured it is as part of the almost the ceremony of the game?
Yeah, in terms of the grievances and so on, like I said, there can be times when two teams are going to play each other and you know there's going to be a fight. We saw that this past year with the Devils and Rangers, two teams that don't like each other very much. And they met, and I might be getting my facts a little bit mixed up, but they met, I believe, in New Jersey. And because of the way the lineups are done, one team gets to choose their lineup first that they put on the ice, and the other team says, okay, they've got those guys out there. Let's put our guys out there. Well, one coach put out their tough guys, and the other coach said, fine, you're going to put out your tough guys. Let me put mine out before the game even started. I mean, the puck dropped, and all of a sudden two or three different couples of guys are fighting each other.
Because these are the guys who have been pre-selected to be the fighters.
Exactly. You know, they know their role, and it's not one of those things where the coach usually does not say, go out there and fight that guy. But they know. They know when they get that tap on the shoulder, that meaning it's your shift next, you go out on the ice next. They know what that means. So, for example, the Devils and Rangers then played several games last season, and when they then played in New York, the same thing happened. The opposite happened. They put their tough guys, we'll put our tough guys. Puck drops, and nobody's going after the puck. All of a sudden, there's four fights on the ice. And as we've seen, or as anybody who's ever watched hockey, especially in the arena, but also on TV, it's for a lot of people, it's the most exciting part of the game. I don't know if they necessarily go to the game for the fights, but people get more excited for a fight than they do usually for a goal. So there's certainly a draw to it. And I think a big question for the NHL and just about anybody else who is trying to market hockey is, how do we balance that popularity of something, especially knowing what we're starting to know about what it does to these guys? You know, what's our responsibility and how do we weigh those two things? But it certainly is, it has a long history in hockey. I mean, the history of hockey goes back more than 100 years, and there were fights. That's how you meted out justice. You know, before there were ever referees, if somebody's being a little too tough on you or being too tough on one of your skilled players, looks like he's trying to take him out of the game, you bring out your bodyguard and you beat him up and see if he'll do it again.
Now, when it came to humanizing these guys, did anyone criticize you for that? Did anyone say, hey, these guys chose to do what they do? They're making millions of dollars a year, some of the top ones. So what's
certainly
the problem, right? So what's your response to that critique?
I think it's interesting. I did hear that a lot. Most people who will defend hockey will say that hey, these guys are being paid. They're being paid well in many cases. And they know what they're getting into, you know. You know, people would say, hey, big surprise, Derek Bogard had brain damage. Well, it's easy for somebody to say that, you know, a big surprise, but we didn't know what kind of brain damage was actually going on. We didn't know exactly what those symptoms were, and hopefully we have and we are continuing to kind of uncover some of that. Where I think it gets a little bit grayer is when you're starting to talk about the youth. You know, Derek was fighting from the time he was about 14 or 15 years old. And there are youth leagues and junior leagues in Canada and in this country where fighting is still part of the game. And so you can say, well, hey, a 28-year-old who's making $1 million a year, maybe I don't feel too sorry for that guy. He should know better, and it's his choice. But a 16-year-old who's feeling the pressure, you know, these guys, a lot of these guys will be from some small town, and they'll get recruited at the age of 14 or 15 years old by a team hundreds of miles away, thousands of miles away. And now they've got the pressures of coaches. They don't know anybody else. They're being told, hey, if you want to continue playing hockey, you don't want to disappoint everybody else who thinks that you can be somebody in this game, you'll do what I say. And so they feel the responsibility to go out there and protect their teammates. And there's a lot of euphemisms in there, you know, protect the teammates,
right,
and things like that. And so they go out and do it. And I think those are the ones that you need to start saying, well, how do you explain this when they're 15 years old?
Give us an idea of the level of brutality we're talking about here. Because almost when we're talking about it here and we're talking about it's ceremonial, it's expected,
right,
you'd think they're going through the motions. But, I mean, these guys are really caving each other's faces in some cases, right?
They are, and it can be brutal. What's interesting is that a lot of people will say, hey, these guys aren't really hurting each other. That they almost think it's like fake wrestling or something. And they just think it's kind of show. And because the guys are on skates, and of course it's slippery and everything else, there are a lot of times that a lot of punches aren't landed. So you're watching a fight and you're like, you know, there's a lot of swinging and a lot of action, but they're not really landing anything squarely. But you have to remember, too, that these guys, when they fight, the first thing they do is flip off their gloves. With a flick of their wrist, their gloves fly off. They wear their gloves that way for a reason. And so it's bare-knuckled brawling. Some leagues will say you have to keep your helmet on, but lots of times they'll have them very loose. So the first time you get hit, your helmet flies off. So in most cases, it's knuckles on faces. And that can be brutal. And Todd Fedoric was one that we talked to at length about his experience. He became a good friend and a confidant and a teammate of Derek Bogard's. But about a year before any of that happened, Derek Bogard shattered his face. And Todd, you know, described it to us as, you know, as soon as he hit me, I knew. And I put my hand up to my cheek, and there was just nothing there. It was just shattered. And he had to have his whole face kind of rebuilt and screws and everything else in his face. And it really ruined his career because he came back and tried to prove himself again, but he always said that he was, you know, always favoring that side. I mean, he always had them back of his mind.
Now, tell us about what methods did you use to reconstruct Bogard's history of drug abuse and his prescriptions?
Yeah, he, you know, a lot of it came from his father, Len. I should say just about all of it came from his father, Len. Len, as I said, was a street cop, Mountie in Canada. And so after Derek died, Len undertook kind of his own investigation, the most personal investigation you can imagine, I suppose. And he set out to go try to find all the documents he could about Derek's life. And that included everything from bank records to cell phone records. He was taking Derek's cell phone records and cold calling numbers on there to see who answers.
Find out who it was.
Who it was. What do you know about my son? He then requested all the medical files from the teams, from all the doctors. These teams have 7 or 8 team doctors, so he called their private practices or wrote them and said, I'd like to have all the records you have. He got a hold of all the pharmacies, mostly the chains, the Walgreens and the Duane Reads, and said, I'd like to have every record you have of my son.
These are all the same. I mean, I write about healthcare. These are all the same things that I do when I work with patients, mm-hmm. you know, who give us permission. Obviously, there's mm-hmm. privacy issues and mm-hmm. but when they give us permission to do their stories, I mean, any healthcare reporter who's doing any investigative story involving a patient, you get all these same records, right?
Yep.
I mean, you can really document
absolutely
what happened.
Absolutely. And Len was interesting. I went up to, it's been a month or so or more, up to his house in Ottawa where he lives now. And he has a basement office, and he would just spend hours and hours and days collecting all this information. And then he put it all into different computer files and would cross-reference it. And when I went up there, it was so well organized, you know, kind of chronological or, hey, tell me this phone number. How many times did Derek call and when? So you could just pull up a phone number and say, oh, yeah, that doctor, he talked to him 4 times in June on these dates. He texted him on these dates, talked to him for 7 minutes here. I mean, it was amazing all the work he had done. And he said it's just like what he does for a regular investigation. He
right.
treated it as regular investigation. So he had, you know, if you were to print it all out, it'd be, you know, 10 feet tall of documents, I'm sure.
Wow.
So it was impressive, and really then all I did was kind of come along and examine it all and then try to lay it all out.
What story did those documents tell?
Those documents told, in terms of the drugs and the prescriptions, that Derek, you know, the first 3 years in the league, he wasn't given a lot of pain pills. And everyone always said Derek, what made him special as a fighter was that he never complained about the pain. And then he there was a night down in Florida in the fall of 2008 where he got punched in the face by another enforcer and had a tooth that was dangling there. And the tooth was then pulled out in the locker room. And presumably he was given some pills there. You know, other team doctors will sometimes give guys pills when they're on the road. And so presumably he got some pills there. But then within a matter of days, he was suddenly getting all sorts of prescriptions for pain pills, starting with one doctor. But over the next 6 months, and I think this is where things started, you could sort of say this is where it all started to turn for him. Over the next 6 months, he received, I think, 25 prescriptions for hydrocodone or oxycodone from 10 different doctors. You can argue about how many pills he had, you know, was that abnormal, was that too much? But the fact that 10 different doctors, including every single one of the 8 doctors of the Minnesota Wild, prescribed him something along the way in those 6 months during that season.
Now, it could speak to the fragmentation of our healthcare, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, doctors don't necessarily know what other doctors are doing.
Absolutely. And one thing is, too, that there is, you know, now there's the prescription monitoring programs.
Right.
That are
a lot of states.
A lot of states are doing it. And Minnesota has it now. But theirs didn't take effect until 2010. I would think even if theirs had taken effect before this all happened with Derek, I'm not sure that's an excuse. The fact that they didn't have a program at that point, I would think that if you're a team doctor for a team, you should know what other team doctors are doing. I shouldn't have to go look up on a computer whether Dr. A is given something else. Should be enough communication.
At some point, he went through rehab?
He did, yep. So that season, he was prescribed all those pain pills. And he did have a couple surgeries. He had a mouth surgery and a shoulder surgery. So certainly, you know, a lot of patients are given pain pills for those. And then by the summer, according to friends and some family that I've talked to, he had started finding sources in bars in Minneapolis, where he was then augmenting and getting more pain pills. And at the same time, the Wild doctors were giving him pretty heavy doses of Ambien, sleeping pills, during that summer as well. And reported at training camp in September, and within about a week or so, he was sent to the rehabilitation center in California by the NHL and admitted to their substance abuse program. So, you know, if you ask Len Bogart, he'll say, you know, it started with prescriptions. You know, they were trying to help him out with all the pain. He never had any sort of issues that we know of in terms of addictions before any of that happened. And, you know, within a year of all these prescriptions, within months of all these prescriptions, he was in rehab. And so, yeah.
Now, again, I've written a lot about prescription drug abuse. And one of the things that a lot of people say about it, and I'm curious what your response would be to this, is nobody forced him to take those pills. So how do you respond to that line of thinking, which is pretty prevalent among mm-hmm. people, that nobody forced him to take the pills? I mean, he was making a choice to do it himself, right?
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. Nobody forced him to it, and then he was augmenting it by buying more.
Right.
And certainly, I'm sure, you know, I don't know how much we know exactly about this, but I would imagine he at some points was then playing doctors off one another. Maybe a doctor told him no, so he went somewhere else. Maybe he was not being totally truthful about the pain he was going through when he went and met with the doctors. You know, certainly I think doctors are in a very difficult position there. The fact that he didn't, or that he should know, or that, hey, he took these things willingly, I think is somewhat blind in a way that you can say the same thing about concussions and things that he went through. It's like, hey, he should have known. He did this willingly. Had he known that he was going to have CTE, he probably wouldn't have become a fighter. Had he known what drugs would do to him, he wouldn't have taken all those drugs. You know, I don't think we can expect people to know exactly what the ramifications are. And you know, when a doctor gives me something, there's a level of trust there.
Yeah, the point I like to make, too, is that, you know, doctors are responsible for what they prescribe. And so they do need to be careful that they're monitoring somebody for something like addiction before they give them something that could be addictive.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get any sense in... none of the doctors talked to you, is that right?
That's correct.
Did you ever get any sense of whether or not they were looking out? You know, doctors obviously are obligated to take care of the patient's interests first, but these mm-hmm. were also team doctors. Did you ever get any sense of whether there's kind of a conflict of interest with team doctors?
Yeah, there's no doubt there's a conflict of interest. And I think it's as obvious as the fact that some of these team doctors market themselves as team doctors. You know, their websites for their private practices are teamdoc.com or rangersdentist.com
wow.
or something. You know, I live out in New Jersey, and there are doctors out there that you walk into their lobbies, and, you know, the official medical providers of the New York Jets. I mean,
wow.
they're trying to attract
yeah.
patients with that. You know, of course, you'd like to give them the benefit of the doubt that their number one priority is that individual patient. But I think it leads to some questions that should be asked in terms of whose best interests are they trying to serve? The patient, for one, you hope. But secondly, they have owners, managers, coaches whose livelihoods and potential profits, everything else, may rely heavily on whether or not player A gets back on the ice or back on the field. There's some inherent pressure, and whether those pressures are ever dealt to them directly, I don't know. But if you're a doctor, you're thinking it's really important to this team that this guy gets back on the ice. You can feel that. And you know that team is doing things for you. They're giving you free tickets. They're taking care of your family. They're paying you, all that kind of thing. I would imagine there's a lot of conflict going on with these team doctors. And I had several people say, I think we need to take a long, hard look at how these team doctors and their relationship between the teams and the players.
Now, a question about the connection between head injuries and concussions and problems like drug abuse, drug addiction, and depression.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have to be careful as reporters, right, about how we present these things in a story. Like, how concrete is the evidence that getting head injuries and leads to concussions, and concussions lead to brain damage, and brain damage leads to depression and suicide and drug addiction and all these things. Right. Sometimes, you know, you I think with Junior Seau's death, we saw, I think, almost sort of a real extreme case of this. But it happens a lot. You know, when a professional athlete commits suicide and everybody jumps to concussions. And how strong is the evidence between those things? And what were the boundaries that you set when you did this story about how you worded those connections?
Basically, you just have to realize that this is all very, very new science. You know, even the people who are doing the research admit that this is new science. You know, in the case of hockey players, for example, they have examined four brains of former NHL hockey players. All four have had CTE. Now, does that mean that every hockey player who ever gets in the head is going to have CTE? No, of course not. We don't know what the percentage might be, but we know that it does exist. And I think they're very confident that what causes it is repeated trauma to the head, subconcussive even, trauma to the head, which is why we might see it in football players who, even if they don't have one or two serious concussions, they might have many subconcussive hits just from banging into each other, boxers. But we don't know exactly why certain people get it and why others don't. We don't know exactly what the ramifications are. I mean, there's no way to know where Derek Bogard's life was going after this. You know, they can look at his brain after he died and say, this is where it was right now, but we don't know where it would go. So you just have to sort of couch everything and say, we don't know exactly what this means, but here's the evidence that we don't know.
How clear is the science that CTE leads to problems like dementia and depression and those kinds of things?
You know, I don't know how much they know about CTE. It's almost they work it in reverse. They know that people who have been shown to have CTE, many of them, and that's obviously not a very good medical term.
Yeah,
many,
right.
Many of them have shown these symptoms of addictive behavior, impulsive behavior, memory loss. Now, would they have had those without CTE? I mean, if you kind of work it, flip the equation that way around, I don't know.
Was it hard to get hockey players to talk? I'm wondering if that, what method you used. I was surprised by how open some of them were, but I can't imagine that they were all that open.
Yeah, some are not open at all. I don't know if it was hard, but I certainly got turned down by a number of them that just don't want to go there. Hockey, I think, is somewhat unusual in that it, maybe more than even most sports, there's a community of hockey, and they sort of circle the wagons, to use a horrible cliche, but they kind of circle the wagons a little bit to say, hey, outsiders don't understand our game. They don't understand that there's a reason why there are enforcers, that fighting might be important to this game. You know, who are you to try to come into our little world? And it's a pretty, you know, as popular as hockey is, it's very popular in small segments. And so it's those people that are, you know, a little bit leery of outsiders.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit, you know, you can't really blame them, but they're a little bit leery of somebody coming in and trying to judge them and maybe suggesting that the way they've played the game for 100 years should be questioned. And so, yeah, there is some reluctance.
So how did this cultural acceptance of the hockey violence and even the celebration of it affect your reporting?
It didn't. Other than, you know, just like any reporter, you're sort of out to sort of break down myths a little bit. And so I just kind of went into it like, let's just see. You know, we've all seen this. I used to cover hockey. We've all seen these fights. Many of us have stood and cheered them. I used to cover hockey. I covered hockey for a number of years. A lot of people have asked me since, you know, did you always think fighting was bad? What was your opinion of fighting? And I said, you know what? I just always thought it was kind of ridiculous. I never really understood its place. I thought it was sort of a made-up sort of thing, but I never questioned it. I mean, I can't say when I was covering hockey 10 years ago as a beat writer that I ever thought, I'm going to, you know, write some story and try to break this all down. It just was part of the game. And I think maybe even I sort of felt like, you know, who am I to question it? It's been going on for 100 years, and these people... this is the game they love, and you know, I'm just here to cover the game, not to question the game.
Do you question violence in sports now?
Yeah, I do. And obviously, you know, any skepticism is good for a journalist anyway. But I certainly question it. I question it with every sport. You know, I look at football. I look at hockey. I don't think I watch them quite the same way. You know, the highlight tapes that we used to see of big hits in football or fights in hockey, I think there is a smaller group of people that still would say, yeah, I'd like to have some of that. Give me some of that. I think people, you know, our outlook is different. And I think that's healthy. And I think it's certainly healthy for people to at least be thinking about, well, if this is happening to guys that are 28 years old, or when they examine the brain of a former football player who died at the age of 60, my kid maybe is 12 or 13 years old. Do I want him to do this? Now, certainly there are a zillion unanswered questions. Maybe you don't want to be too overreactionary. But, you know, the better safe than sorry thing, I think, has entered a lot of people's minds. And I think that's probably healthy.
The stories, each of them were emotional in their own way, just because they were really tragic. And I'm curious if it took any emotional toll on you when you were doing your reporting and writing these stories. And if so, how do you manage those emotions as a journalist?
You sort of act like you're, you know, some big, you know, objective journalist, and they don't have any sort of stake in it. And I think for the most part, I do that pretty well, because you don't want to emotionally sort of take any sides on any sort of story. But there were some interesting moments in this one. You know, you cannot help, and it wouldn't be any different if it was somebody else who wasn't a hockey player, but a family that's going through a tragedy. But you can't help but feel it when you're talking to the mother. And 3 feet away from her is a cabinet with all of her son's mementos, uniforms, and a little box that has his ashes in it. And we took a long drive up to go visit one of Derek's brothers, and he lives up in northern Saskatchewan. He's also a Canadian Mountie like their father, and is in a really, really tiny area far, far north Saskatchewan. And drove up there, and we did a video interview. And it was interesting for me, because most of what I do is not on video or on camera. And so I'm used to being very conversational. And he was describing, but we were doing this one on camera, and we were knee to knee. You know, I was off camera, but we were basically knee to knee, and he was describing finding his brother's body. And as he did so, you know, obviously his eyes welled up. He would say, you know, I then went around the bed, and he would pause and sort of have this far off look on his eyes for 30 seconds, 45 seconds. And to me, literally 3 feet away from him, if I was not on camera, I'd probably say, hey, you know, maybe try to help him out a little bit.
Right.
But on camera, you don't want to sort of break that. And so you kind of let him go. And he was more than willing to go. And, you know, it was probably 4 or 5 minutes long of him, you know, giving us a sentence or two at a time, and then really sort of pondering it, and then sort of building up to give us the next sentence. Very, very emotional. I mean, I walked out of there just going, wow. I mean, that was tough. And it probably wouldn't have been as tough if I had not been on camera, because I probably would have tried to bail him out,
right,
so to speak.
So does it weigh on you at all when you do these kind of stories? Or
you know, it depends on what it is. This story, I certainly can sympathize, I guess, with the family. I can sympathize with any families that have gone through it. I've talked to other people who have been affected by this kind of stuff. But in a general sense, it tends to be stories that have to do with kids. Those are the ones that really get me. And I have young kids myself. And so anytime there are kids involved, and you sort of see either kids in violence, or kids that are in some sort of what seems like it might be a hopeless situation or something like that, those are the ones that get me.
Yeah. What do you feel like the violence in hockey, and sort of our, not just our acceptance of it, but our thirst for it and our demand for it, kind of says about us as a culture? Have you reflected on that at all?
I have, and I don't know exactly. I mean, people will tell you, you know, hey, back to Roman days, you know, we've
sure
been cheering this kind of stuff on. These guys are just modern-day gladiators.
Yeah.
But I think it's fascinating. I mean, there are several websites devoted to hockey fights, very popular websites and very well-done websites, where you can go on and they will track all the statistics by player of how many fights they're in. And the next day you can look and see, you know, in the Russian Hockey League, there were this many fights, and here's a YouTube clip of this fight that we saw. And then people judge them and they comment on them. And those are still going. And as people that work on those boards and those websites tell me, you know, there might be hockeyfights.com, but you don't see a whole lot of hockeygoals.com. There's something about the hockey fights that get people worked
yeah
up. You know, we're not judging goals. Wow, what a pretty goal. Give
right
it an 8 out of 10. That doesn't happen. And so there's something about this that people just are drawn to. And I think what's happening now more and more, and I think this is obviously very healthy, is that people are starting to think, what's the story behind the story? These are not cartoon characters out there. There's real pain being inflicted. I think we've seen that with the demise, or the decline, I think, of boxing is one. You know, that's a very obvious example. I think people sort of lost their thirst in some ways for that. But now we see MMA.
The rise of the UFC and MMA.
Right.
Has been...
And somehow we see that different. And, I don't know why. I don't know why we sort of shift and say, somehow this one's okay. The rounds are shorter. The bouts are shorter. Is there something more safe about this?
They can tap out, I suppose.
They can tap out,
but
I suppose.
It's brutal. There's no way to
cut it. Those guys are getting beat up, too. And so I think it's a shrinking minority of people that will look at those kinds of things and say, I have no problem with that. I think people in the back of their mind kind of know there's something more there, and maybe that should affect the way I view this from now on.
Go to the New York Times website to read Punched Out, the series by John Branch. And for more of the best accountability journalism, go to ProPublica.org and click the Muckreads tab. To suggest stories for Muckreads, use the Muckreads hashtag on Twitter or email a link to the story to muckreads@propublica.org.